from the high desert in the great American Southwest. I bid you all good evening, good morning, good afternoon, wherever you may be ensconced in the world's 25 time zones, all of them covered one way or to the other by, or the other, yeah, that's what I meant to say, by this incredible program, Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell. Weekend edition is certainly an honor to be with you this weekend. In the next hour, Peter Davenport's going to be here from the UFO Reporting Center in Seattle. And he has been talking to me for a number of years, actually, about something that it's so shockingly simple and effective that I wonder if it's going to get him in trouble. I really do. Because there is a way to look for UFOs, but it's going to find a lot of other stuff, too, and so there might be the trouble. We'll see. In the meantime, remember last night what we called the Japan incident? Well, I got the following email today, and I'm sure this is indeed the answer. Art Bell, I'm a pilot for American Airlines, flying a Boeing 777 between DFW, that'd be Dallas-Fort Worth, and Tokyo-Narita airports. The mysterious lights in the Sea of Japan are indeed the lights of the Japanese fishing fleet. The first time I saw them, I remarked that they appeared as bright as the lights of a large city, as I mentioned to you last night. Perhaps the water magnifies and adds to their luminosity, therefore making the lights appear larger and more numerous. Most of the eastbound Japan to U.S. flights, that is, are at night. But, you see, passengers don't get a very good view of these lights from their small little windows. The cockpit, however, has an excellent view of them, and they are quite amazing. The pictures on your website show lights west of Japan, but I have seen the Japanese fishing fleet hundreds of miles east and southeast of Japan. Apparently, the fleet goes where the fishing is good. American Airlines, Boeing 777, First Officer Eric Lightsey. That's Lightsey. Thank you very much, Eric. I'm sure you're corrected. It does beg a few questions. Indeed, how could the luminosity be magnified to the point that they would appear larger and brighter, or as bright as the lights of Tokyo or Seoul? It's incredible. But it's also incredible to think how they're fishing those seas. Now, I know the Japanese and, of course, the Chinese eat fish as a main staple, but at that rate, pretty soon there won't be any more fish. I wonder if anybody's thinking about that. I mean, they're literally sweeping the sea of fish. And then we also talked last night about rogue waves. You know, these 100-foot monster waves that were the thing of myth and legend at sea. Sailors have talked of them for years. And everybody thought myth and, you know, sea story. Well, I read that little thing about the European satellite that says, no, they're not a myth. In fact, they detected 10 at any single moment with their satellite. And then I began receiving photographs today taken at sea by sailors. Got one on the website right now on my webcam. And a very good friend of mine, John, who's a ham, by the way, spent his entire adult life until retirement on these freighters. And he writes, hey, Art, thanks for the picture. I sent him some of these. It's a good one, he says. I've come home a lot of times with stories of waves and rogue waves out there, but only as a rule of thumb, only the seagoing people would believe me. I've made many trips to Alaska on an empty tanker, which is a terrible thing, as its center of gravity is way off, and she's basically top-heavy and will roll over very easily. You see, they empty them prior to entering port on single-hull tankers because the ballast is contaminated, and it costs large sums of dollars to pump it ashore for cleanup prior to loading cargo. Many times, you think the last roll will be the last, or the last swell you climb over then head down, bow down over the other side of the swell, you think you just might keep heading down. So those big monster rogue waves are indeed out there. And if you look at my webcam, you'll see one tanker about to encounter one of them directly ahead. Must be a very frightening thing. And a picture doesn't really do it justice in understanding truly how big that wave is. Well, look, we're in the middle of a monstrous solar storm right now. I mean, this baby is gigantic. My understanding is we have presently an A count, for those of you that know what it means, an A count of 129 and a K count of 7. It got to 8 last night. Auroras were seen widely. In fact, tonight it's going to happen again, and I would recommend as many of you in the northern latitudes as possible who have semi or clear skies, get the heck out there and take a look. And if you see any good auroras, snap a photograph and send it, because we're getting bombarded by the sun. I mean really bombarded. The following off Whitley Strieber's Unknown Country, I believe it came from New Scientist. Scientists hope that the solar wind will form a barrier that will protect us from the solar radiation during the upcoming pole shift here on Earth. Remember that? Remember the pole shift story, right? Well, when the poles reverse on Earth, which has happened many times before, the magnetic shield that protects us from solar radiation is temporarily weakened. Mars was not so lucky. Astronomers report that Mars had extensive oceans and probably life until about 3.5 billion years ago. Huge solar storms of the kind that flared up in the fall of 2003 hit Mars repeatedly, boom, 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 like that, and sucked up all its water, leaving it a dead planet. What scientists want to know is, could it happen to us? Deborah Zabrinko quotes NASA's Ed Stone as saying, quote, these solar radiation events can affect the surface of Mars because Mars has so little protection, but during the pole shift, which is now underway, we may not have any protection either. You see, we know the Earth's magnetic poles will flip soon and that they've done it in the past, but the magnetic field is what protects us from being roasted by the sun's ultraviolet rays, as well as by cosmic rays from space. Now, how are we going to survive the long period when this field is weakened during the pole reversal? Some scientists are hoping that we'll be protected by the very solar wind that will do vast damage to our electronic infrastructure. And you think you've got trouble with your computer now. Marcus Schaun writes in New Scientist that the Earth could interact with the solar wind to create a replacement field in the upper atmosphere during the switch. Before this, scientists feared we'd be left without any protection for thousands of years. But since the pole flip has occurred hundreds of times in the past 400 million years and life seems to have survived, they assume that there's some kind of protection they don't know about. Astronomers created a computer program that shows what will happen during the pole reversal. The solar wind, which is a million-mile-an-hour stream of hydrogen and helium coming from the sun, will wrap itself around the Earth in a way that creates a magnetic field as strong as the one it's replacing. They hope. So, at a moment when we're having, and this is that moment, we're having incredible solar storms right this very moment. We've been bombarded by one flare after another. Major flare is just hitting us like crazy this far out on the downside of the solar cycle that it bears thinking about that field up there that protects us. More in a moment. Steve of Walton, New York writes, hey Art, holy mackerel, on my way to work this morning, there was enough fog in the Delaware Valley and tin on my windshield to diffuse the sun disk so I could look at it without burning my eyes. Art, I was shocked at what I saw. It appears to be SS-652 glaring back at me, an oblong spot that was easily seen as I kept one eye on the road and one eye on the sky to be sure it wasn't something on my windshield. I shifted my line of sight, and the next time the conditions were right, I looked back the second time. There it was. I've never seen anything like this before, and all I could think of was Ed Dame's comments from last weekend's show. I'm starting to think Ed might be right. Well, yes, the sunspot, there's a very, very large one now past the center of the disk, headed away, that may be decaying a little bit, but it was a monster. Coming soon for your enjoyment, sunspot number 666. I wonder if anybody's thought about that. They number them consecutively, and 666 will be coming soon. It'd be interesting to watch. Or this art. My South Korean wife has shared with me that it has been the hottest summer ever in her home country. You see, we don't get this information. Here you go, from South Korea. It has been so hot that many South Koreans have been dying, just like what occurred in France last summer. Where it has been colder than usual this summer, perhaps you've heard, but the French government distributed air conditioners around Paris this last year. Oh, my goodness. Only the population has no need to turn them on, because this July, it's been cold enough in Paris to snow, outside Munich, to snow, where I've got some relatives. I share the news about South Korea because I haven't seen it broadcast on any national media. And I found this of interest. After 21 years of raising peacocks, peafowl, and having written two best-selling self-published peacock books and peafowl newsletters in the world, entitled, I guess, The Wacky World of Peafowl Books and Peafowl Report Newsletter, Dennis Fett of Minden, Iowa, owner of peacockinformation.com, thought that he had written and seen everything when it comes to peacocks and peafowl until December 1 of 2001, when doing his daily chores in the India Blue Pen that day, he noticed that one bird seemed to look a bit different, was appearing darker in the face. Then, on closer examination, this 14-year-old India Blue peahen that was once his best egg layer wasn't looking like a peahen anymore. Not a female, in other words. She seemed to be having a major sexual identity crisis. Her feathers, in fact, the ones all over her body, are now changing color, looking much more like a male peacock. In addition, she is now starting to grow several long, beautiful tail feathers, as seen on her male counterpart. She is now a he. A rather unnatural and unwanted sex change. This oddity is very rare. On peacockinformation.com, we've only received two reports of this oddity by way of their website, with 500 to 800 visitors daily over the last 6 years. The website has received one other letter before the internet days of this condition about 15 years ago. Research is now underway to try and learn more about the condition, but when you hear of animals, birds, changing sex in midlife or even late life for a bird, that is pretty weird. Of course, there are a lot of weird things going on right now. We are dead into the middle of the quickening. I've been in radio a lot of years. I imagine a lot of my board operators have been too. Somebody sent this along, and I thought I'd read a few of them. You know you're an aging radio DJ when you were first hired by a GM who actually worked in radio before becoming GM. Radio stations were no place for kids. You excitedly turn the radio up at the sound of dead air on the competition station. Oh, God, this is awful. It's so true. You know, you hear your competitor and you hear dead air, and you turn the dial all the way up and you listen to the hiss of the background carrier, and you're all excited. Sales guys wore Old Spice to cover up the smell of liquor. Engineers could actually fix things without sending them back to the manufacturer. You worked for only one station, and you could name the guy who owned it. Radio stations used to have enough on-air talent to field a softball team every summer. You know the difference between good reel-to-reel tape and cheap reel-to-reel tape. Religious radio stations were locally owned, run by an old Protestant minister and his wife, never had more than 20 listeners at any given time, and still made money. You have a white wax pencil, a razor blade, and a spool of 3M splicing tape in your desk drawer, just in case. You can post a record, run down the hall, go to the bathroom, and be back in 2 minutes and 50 seconds for the segue. You knew exactly where to put the tone on the end of a carded song. You only did, I like this one, you only did make goods if the client complained. Otherwise, who cares? Somebody would say you have a face for radio and it was still funny. 60% of your wardrobe has a station logo on it. You always had a screwdriver in the studio so you could take a fouled up card apart at a moment's notice. Oh my God, all of this is true. You would spend hours splicing and editing a parody tape until it was just right. But you didn't give a damn how bad that commercial was you recorded. Hell, I can only work with what they give me, right? You still refer to CDs as records. You played practical jokes on the air without fear of lawsuits. You answer your home phone with the radio station call letters. You knew how to change the ribbon on the teletype machine, but you hated to do it because that was the news guy's job. You have several old air check cassettes in your cardboard box in your closet. You wouldn't dream of letting anyone hear them anymore, but you never throw them out and never will. Never. You still have dreams of a song running out and not being able to find the control room door. That happened to me. Some control room doors had locks on them. It was... You have at least 19 pictures of you with famous people whom you haven't seen since and wouldn't know today if you bit them on... Well, you get the idea. You wish you could have been on Name That Tune because you would have won $1 million. You even remember Name That Tune. You can still hit the beginning of a song on an album with a stylus and slip cue that sucker while potting it up so the cue burn isn't so bad. You know what slip cueing a record is. And it goes on and on and on. The one I like, you can remember when smoking in the Air studio was mandatory. I don't know if I'm going to have time to get through this. This is the log of somebody who just moved to my state of Nevada. Moved to Nevada, May 30th. Just moved to Nevada. Now, this is a state who knows how to live. Beautiful sunny days, warm, balmy evenings. What a place. Beautiful. I found my home. I love it. June 14th. Really heating up. Got to 100 today. Not a problem. Live in an air-conditioned home. Drive an air-conditioned car. What a pleasure to see the sun every day like this. I'm turning into a sun worshiper. June 30th. Had the backyard landscaped in western plants today. Lots of cactus and rocks. What a breeze to maintain. No more mowing a lawn for me. Another scorcher today, but I love it. June 10th. The temperature hasn't been below 100 all week. How do people get used to this kind of heat? At least it's windy, though. I was getting used to the heat. But it's taken a little longer than I expected. July 15th. Fell asleep by the community pool. Got third-degree burns over 60% of my body. Missed 3 days of work. What a dumb thing to do. Learned my lesson, though. Got to respect the old sun in a climate like this. July 20th. I missed Lomita, my cat, sneaking into the car when I left this morning. By the time I got into the car at high noon, well, Lomita had died, swollen up to the size of a shopping bag, and stank up the upholstery. The car now smells like kibbles and, well, I can't say it. I learned my lesson, though. No more pets in this heat. July 25th. The wind sucks. It feels like a giant freaking blow dryer and it's hot as hell. The home air conditioner is on the fritz and the AC repairman charged me $200 just to drive by and tell me he needed to order parts. July 30th. Been sleeping outside on the patio for 3 nights now, $225,000 house, and I can't even go inside. Why did I ever come here? August 4th. It's 115 degrees. Finally got the AC fixed today. Cost me $500. And gets the temperature down to 85 degrees. I hate this stupid state. August 8th. Another wise ass. If another wise ass cracks hot enough for you today, I'm going to strangle him. Damn heat. By the time I get to work, the radiator's boiling over. My clothes are soaking wet. I smell like a baked cat. August 9th. Tried to run some errands. Anyway, it goes on and on. Finally, August 14th. Welcome to hell. Temperature 120 today. Forgot to crack the window and blew the damn windshield out of the car. Installer came to fix it and said, hot enough for you today? That was it. My sister had to spend $1,500 to bail me out of jail. Freaking Nevada. What kind of sick, demented idiot would want to live here? We'll write letter to let you know how the trial goes. That's my state, Nevada.
Sweet dreams are made of these.
With Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
All right, that's it, folks. Numbers are a little bit different on the weekend, but make note and dial carefully lest you wake up Perumpians in the middle of the night. All that in mind, to the phones in a moment. To the awaiting scrambled gene pool we go. You're on the air, first-time caller line, Coast to Coast AM. Hi.
Hi, this is Mark in Sonora calling you from AM 1450 KVML. How are you doing?
You guys are well-trained. Very well, thank you. So what's up in Sonora?
Oh, we've got a lot of anomalous objects in the sky here for the last past 2 months or so.
What kind of anomalous objects?
Oh, let's see. We've had cylindrical objects. We've had triangular objects both day and night. Since July 6th, we've had a lot of glowing objects.
And have you reported these things to the appropriate authorities, people like Peter Davenport?
Yes, we have.
You have? Okay, good.
Oh, definitely. Talk to Peter Davenport. I email him all the time about what's going on here.
Uh-huh.
Everything that we've got here has been recorded on videotape.
And are other Sonorians noticing all this?
A few of them. I've been talking to people around here, and they've been noticing things.
It's really astounding how many people don't look up.
Exactly.
They just don't. In the course of everyday life, you know, they're busy, and they don't look up. I mean, they could miss a mothership.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We've had a lot of them here. Almost every night since July 6th, we've had them. Every night, we stand outside looking up and just watch the sky.
Why do you think the mad rush on Sonora?
I'm not really sure. There's not really much around here. We're a small town in the
foothills. Well, there's you.
Yeah. It makes me wonder about that, but I don't think I want to go there.
Well, keep your eyes on the sky. And what I said about people not looking up is correct. If people did look up, we'd have many, many, many more. I was joking, say, you know, said miss the mothership, but it's entirely possible. people really are intent on what they're doing, and they could easily miss something very important in the sky directly above them. Wildcard Line, you're on the air. Hi.
Art.
Yes.
This is John in Atlanta.
Hi, John.
Listen, 105.3 FM.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to comment on that incredible interview you did with Dean Radin a few weeks ago.
Oh, yes.
But first, a suggestion for Dr. Doom, Mr. Ed Dames.
Yes.
You know, he's been making some pretty astounding prognostications about our potentially cataclysmic near future for
years, actually.
For years now, yeah, on your program. He says that he acquires this information by remote viewing in Teams.
That's correct.
Now, given the fact, you know, that I have not heard anybody else, none of the other remote viewers out there, corroborate his information. I've spent a lot of time on different remote viewing sites for years, and nobody has corroborated this information.
Wait a minute now. I've interviewed most of the major, you know, known remote viewers in the country, the big names, and they don't look or even try to look at the stuff that Ed Dames looks at.
Well, even Aaron Donahue, when you had him on, a lot of the stuff he says is highly questionable, but he did say Ed Dames is the best remote viewing teacher out there, but then he went on to say that he was all wet on Planet X, and I believe he said that he's looked high and low for this, you know, his claims on Planet X, and he said it's just not out there.
It does seem like they ought to, you know, if remote viewing is accurate, then they should agree, but... You know, I guess there's human aspects of this that are interjected into it all. I will say this, though. Ed has been consistent in what he said over the years. Timelines, everybody expects something said to occur tomorrow. Well, it doesn't work that way. But with the way the sun has been behaving lately, I think people would do well to remember what Ed's been saying for years.
Well, given the highly... potentially cataclysmic nature of what he's saying, I would like to suggest that maybe he has some other people on that would corroborate, or some of the other individuals that he remote views and teams with on with him to.
That's a good idea. That's good. I like that idea.
But you know, Mr. Dean Radin, that was an amazing interview you did with him. He was talking about how these random number generating nodes were actually becoming more less random prior to September 11th.
That's right.
And
they have the charts to prove it. In fact, we posted those charts on the website, sir.
What was even more amazing, he was talking about this website, I think it was gotsci.com, that he has, that he invites individuals to come on and practice their psychic skills. And he found out that even a longer period of time prior to September 11th, what took place was the hits dropped tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
And which is pretty significant finding there. It would suggest to me that there was some kind of possible disturbance in the collective mind, maybe, that individuals' hits would drop because, you know, maybe they were picking up on this particular event, September 11th, happening, and it lessened their psychic ability.
I'm with you all the way. Look, I know, and I think the Gotsci website's a really good idea, although at the time, you may recall, as I did the interview, I wondered that if somebody really Gotsci, I mean, if you had somebody come in there and ace the test, boom, 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 all the tests like that, pretty soon you'd get a on the door. And so, you know, I wonder about all that. I would think so anyway. I mean, there's obviously monitoring the results of the tests, right? And they've got IP numbers. And if somebody was really, really, really good, like to have a talk with you, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, whatever. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, Eric.
Hello.
This is Douglas calling from Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Yes.
The MT-600.
Yes, sir.
And I had a comment to make on SETI. I know Ray Kramer, he used to be an engineering professor at Ohio State University for over 35 years. And he was working on an equation that you could communicate on gravity waves 16 times faster than the speed of light. And
trouble with that theme is that the people that I've asked recently have said that gravity travels at the speed of light.
Oh, well, okay. But anyway, this is what he was working on. So, but anyway, I just wanted to make the comment that possibly if there was a civilization far out in another galaxy and they were trying to communicate with us, their system of communication might be even faster than that.
And well, it might be perhaps the speed of thought. Now, if the speed of gravity is equal to that of the speed of light, then we don't yet know of anything that travels faster than the speed of light, required, obviously, to make any serious trips, right? But perhaps the speed of thought, whatever that may be, and there is every indication it may exceed the speed of light. If, in fact, there is a speed to thought at all, west of, other than inside your own cranium. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, this is Mark from Victoria, British Columbia, Canada.
Hey, buddy.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment and inform you about the weather. We just came off a heat wave which hit 34 degrees Celsius, which is 100 degrees Fahrenheit, when the normal temperatures are like 75 degrees Fahrenheit.
I know. I have a lot of friends in B.C. I talk to them every day, and what's going on weather-wise is way upside down.
Can I ask you about the coming global superstorm? I mean, we live in the Pacific Northwest here, and you pretty much covered the Atlantic currents. But I read an article which explained that Juneau, Alaska, has a good growing season. I was just stunned, and it explained that there's a current, an actual hot current.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Keeps
so
Juneau kind of mainly. Juneau has a climate not all that different than Seattle.
Yeah. So wouldn't that, the reasoning, the same thing as the Gulf Stream turning back in Europe, would it not be the same kind of mechanism? Would it not be the same kind of possible reaction?
Yes. Yeah. The answer is yes. The currents that keep Juneau warm and kind of generally wet, if disturbed, could have an equally disturbing outcome should they change. And we are now beginning to monitor these ocean currents very carefully, all of them. And we're beginning to note slowings and the possibility even of stoppings that would have a dramatic and a very, very fast. I would recommend that all of you, aside from whatever I'm able to tell you with what information I can glean from listeners around the world, because we do have them around the world, that as much as you're able, you monitor weather conditions outside the U.S. and around the world. We simply are not getting news of what's going on, and baby, there is a lot going on. First time caller line, you're on the air. Hello.
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 Hi, Art.
Turn your radio off, please.
Oh, sure. Hold on a second.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry
Always
about that.
Do that immediately upon connection.
Oops.
Tum, 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 tum. Not up.
Okay.
There you go. There you go.
Oh, okay. I have two things I like to say. One, this is the best show I ever heard, and secondly, I think you covered everything about the paranormal and the UFOs, and I'd like to say thanks, and sorry how rude of me. My name is Mark from New York, and I listen to you from WABC on the weekend, so too bad I can't get you on a weekly basis. But recently, a few years ago, I was living in Long Island, New York, and my father, God rest his soul, we noticed some strange lights over where we are in Brentwood, Long Island, and we called MacArthur Airport, and we asked them if you have seen anything, you know, flying by, anything like that. They told us no, but my father and I thought it might be a possibility that we might be visited.
Well, and anything's possible. Listen, you are a listener, obviously, to 77 WABC. Do you listen to Curtis Sliwa?
Oh, yeah, he's funny.
Yeah, he's funny. Curtis is real funny. Listen to this. Reputed mafia members indicted in murder attempt on talk radio host. After 12 years, John Gotti Jr. has been indicted for planning the attempted hit on WABC talk show host Curtis Sliwa. Three other reputed mafia members were also indicted along with him for attempted murder, all picked up last night. This is a few days ago now. except for Gotti, who is still in prison for earlier crimes. It was June of 1992 when Curtis was coming to work at WABC to do his morning show around 5 a.m., got in a cab outside his Greenwich Village apartment. A masked gunman was hiding in the front seat, rose up and shot Curtis 5 times in the lower abdomen while Curtis struggled with a gun. The cab wrecked into the curb while Curtis crawled out of the back window, bleeding, yelling as best he could for help. The gunman and cab driver, apparently both mafia hitmen, ran off thinking that he was a dead man. Well, Curtis wasn't dead, and to this very day is on WABC in New York. I met him when I was there. Curtis and I had sort of a little tiffed going for a while about certain hours of airtime. So that's a little history on Curtis. Wildcard Line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hey, Art, how you doing?
All right, sir.
It's Kevin in Oklahoma.
Yes, sir.
I wanted to comment about last night's guest. That was a good comment you made at the end. You can't always agree with people, but it's good to have the conversation anyway.
Well, actually, the comment I made was that when you don't agree with them, sometimes it's better because you get a more animated, interesting conversation.
Yeah, that's true. And he was pretty adamant about a lot of things.
Oh,
yeah. But that cloning issue of his, you know, I mean, how can somebody expect to clone an arm or a liver or a heart or something like that without having the nervous system, the endocrine system, and all these glands that, you know, help make up the operation of these organs?
I don't know. I've wondered about that for a long time myself. I understand Ron Reagan is going to make an appeal at the Democrats' convention, just about to start, for stem cell research to go forward full speed. And so it's going to look an awful lot like Ron Reagan is endorsing the Democrats.
Well, I agree with the stem cell research. You can find stem cells in the umbilical cord, you know, between the child and the placenta.
Yes.
You don't have to always get it from an aborted fetus. You can still find it elsewhere.
Well, apparently there's some class of stem cells that they do consider to be very important. Right now, the law says, I guess, that you can only use those stem cells that were researched prior to the change in law.
Okay. All right, appreciate it. Take care.
Okay, take care. East of the Rockies, you are on the air. Hello.
Oh, hello?
Yes. Turn your radio off, please.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right.
Oh, I want to talk about those radioactive materials they found in Iraq, 2,000 pounds and plus isotopes.
I've seen some things on the Internet about that. I don't know the specifics, but they have found something.
Well, on New York Times, on July 7th, on page 86, they had written about what they found.
Mm-hmm.
And when the war started, they found it right away, but they gave it a test, and they found out that the radioactive material was so hot, they had to seal it up right away. The needle went off the Geiger counter.
Yeah,
that's how hot it was.
I'm going to have to get caught up on that before I can converse intelligently on it. But there are, and have been, of course, for some time now, rumors of what has been found, this or that, in Iraq. But generally, they've, in the end, turned out to be nothing. First-time caller line, you're on the air. Hello.
Yes, my name is Anthony. I'd like to talk about a dream.
A dream? A dream, Anthony?
Yes, sir.
And what did you dream?
When I was 15 years old, my grandmother lived with me, and she pretty much raised me because when my parents both worked 2 jobs, and when I was 15, she died. And I didn't realize it, but I went into a deep depression, and I had a dream that I was at her funeral again, and she got up out of her casket and gave me a hug and kissed and said that she loved me, and then she walked away and started talking to the other people. And it made me angry. And it took about 3 years later, I figured out that it was either her or my mind telling me just to let her go and live my life.
Well, that's one of the things that I wonder so much about with these dreams and supposed insights and things that we have. On the one hand, they might be real, and on the other, they may be a protective device of the mind. I mean, when something very tragic occurs to you, like a relative or somebody very close to you dying, your mind is trying to find a way, as it does, with dealing with death, dealing with mortality. And so it may well be that the mind concocts its own a dream, particularly or its own version of events in a way that you can understand and comfort you. And somebody getting up out of their casket, shocking as it may be, hugging you, giving a little kiss and saying all's going to be all right, may be your brain's way of dealing you a way you can handle this. I don't know. Big question. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello?
Yes. Hi, Art. I've been trying to get a hold of you for a few months. Back in late April, I was in Los Angeles, and I saw three black helicopters at about 7 a.m. fly over Hollywood. And about 2 hours later, they were flying in the same formation, the same way over the city of Los Angeles. I called my wife back here on the East Coast. I'm from Albany, WGY, by the way. And she said she observed the same, not the same, but three helicopters flying in a formation at approximately the same time, East Coast time.
Yes. Okay.
I wanted to bring that to your attention. These were like black helicopters, kind of like flying a patrol.
Well, I'm not...
They weren't, you know, it wasn't the LAPD or anything. And
right.
She said she saw, I described the helicopters to her, and she said she saw almost the exact
I've got that. All right. Well, we get them here as well. I mean, they're everywhere. Maybe not everywhere, but they certainly are here. We have black helicopters galore here. So I guess I don't think black helicopters are a big deal. They're just, you know, they're black helicopters and doing who knows what. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell. Peter Davenport is next.
Now it begins. Now that you're gone. Needles and pins. What have you done? Watching that clock. Till you return. Tying that door.
Interested in a trip to the moon? Some may.
With Art Bell. Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM. with Art Bell.
It is coming. Peter Davenport. Peter Davenport is director of the National UFO Reporting Center. He was the founding president of a Seattle-based biotechnology company, which currently employs over 300 scientists and technicians. Peter has had an active interest in the UFO phenomenon from his early boyhood. He experienced his first UFO sighting over the St. Louis Municipal Airport in the summer of 1954, and he investigated his first UFO case during the summer of 1965 in Exeter, New Hampshire. Peter has been witness to several anomalous events, possibly UFO-related, including a dramatic sighting over Baja California in February of 1990 and several nighttime sightings over Washington State during 1992. In addition to being director of the National UFO Reporting Center, Peter has served as the director of investigations for the Washington chapter of the Mutual UFO Network. Peter has an idea. This idea is so good that it may well get him in trouble, although publicizing, I suppose, is your best bet. It's such a simple idea that those of you with some knowledge of electronics, I think, are going to be shocked. Others may have considered the possibility. But in terms of looking for UFOs, Peter has the $64 million idea. And we're going to be discussing that this evening. First, though, a UFO report with a witness coming up in a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, Peter Davenport. I'm sure you know him. He's been here over many, many years now, doing shows with me since, how long, Peter?
I think the first show we did together, Art, was February 19th, 1995. So it's been about 9.5 years now.
Yeah, a while.
It has been.
So how's the world of ufology?
Boy, it is booming, Art. For a host of reasons, we're getting many more reports than we've gotten in the past. Many of them good reports. In fact, our audience will hear one of the best I think we've gotten in the last 6 months or so tonight with a witness. I'm looking forward to bringing him on. But the world of ufology is it's kept me very busy, more busy than I ever thought I would be in this job. But things are going on, that's for sure.
Well, I'm hearing that from all corners, that all of a sudden across a lot of the world, we're in the middle of a flap. I guess that's the old word, right?
Yep. Yes, indeed. I happen to believe that's the case, too, but it's very difficult to document that. It's very difficult to perform statistical analysis on the reports we get because they're coming from so many different directions, so many different people. There's no consistency in the way most reports are collected. So it's very difficult to know anything for sure. All we have is sort of qualitative reports to the effect that something clearly is going on. 4th of July this year, a case in point. Something based on probably a couple dozen reports that we received. Something appears to have passed across the United States on the evening of 4th of July this year. I have no idea what it was, but the reports that came in appear to have been independent of one another. That is, it's not a group of people in collusion. And something just flew across the United States. People can see the data on our website. We just posted newly received reports tonight.
Eyewitness reports?
Eyewitness reports.
Uh-huh.
Now, a skeptic, of course, would say, oh, well, 4th of July fireworks and brush his hands off and leave it at that. But
no, I wouldn't say that. I the first hour, I was commenting on that. We've talked about it before. I know people don't look up.
Yeah.
Well, except maybe on the 4th of July when that's what they're supposed to do.
Yeah. That's a very good point. They're outside. They're looking. They're expecting something to hit, to take place in the night sky. So
exactly.
The conditions are good for a sighting of anything that might be anomalous.
Of course, yes.
Very good point.
Also, a bad time to fly. I mean, if you are a UFO and you don't want to be spotted, a very bad time to fly. If you do want to be spotted, and that's something I'm sure we'll discuss, whether or not they really want to be seen, then it'd be a great time to fly because everybody's looking up.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Something very similar happened just 7 years ago. I remember the date. It was Friday, the 4th of July, 1997. The first report we got that that evening was from an FAA air traffic controller in Paducah, Illinois, just on the south side of the Ohio River.
Mm-hmm.
He said he was in the tower. He was on duty at Paducah Airport looking north, and he saw a dramatic fireball come straight down in the northern sky from his vantage point, straight down in the night sky, and he braced himself for an explosion. In point of fact, that object appears to have leveled out when it got close to the ground, and it streaked across Illinois. It streaked across Missouri, where it is reported by many people to have stopped, and then it disappeared to wherever it was headed. But these events are taking place all the time. It is a subject that you and I have discussed now for almost a decade is why is the press not covering these events? Why do they not touch the subject of ufology? That is even more interesting to me than the issue of UFOs themselves.
It is interesting, and they do, of course, to some degree cover it. Television needs pictures, you know, and sometimes, and lately, I guess, with all the camcorders, we've been getting more pictures than we used to. But they, yep. Number one, they need pictures.
Yep.
Number two, if they just cover somebody saying, hey, you know, I saw such and such, well, I don't know how interesting that is anymore.
Yeah.
At any rate, we've got a witness right now, don't we?
We do indeed. Art, I'm looking forward to going to him here in a minute, but before we go to him, I'd like to take just a minute, if I could, to talk about one of my colleagues out in Ohio. In fact, he's been on this program. You'll recognize the name immediately, Kenny Young.
Of course.
From Cincinnati. He's brought some just dramatic information to your audience and to many other audiences. I have dealt with a lot of UFO investigators in the 10 years that I've been director here in Seattle. I haven't found one that does the job of UFO investigation and communication better than Kenny does. And I mention all of this because just over the last week, he's had some really, really tough medical problems with, I didn't realize it, but he's been suffering with leukemia all these years that he's been doing this wonderful work he does out there.
Wow.
And he's taken a turn for the worst, and I just wanted to bring this to the attention of our audience because he's certainly one of the best UFO investigators in this country today.
Many of my audience, this audience, will remember the incredible audio we had of the officers who had the sighting. It was in the Ohio area, the Midwest area.
Yeah.
And that was Kenny. Remember, folks? Yes. And what's going on?
Trumbull County. And he's having a really hard time, and I just wanted to start off this program, Art, by letting him know that he's in our heart and our prayers tonight, and we wish him the best. We hope he can get through this and continue his work, but I just thought it would be appropriate to say a few words and wish him the best tonight.
Indeed, the best.
So,
okay, thank you, Peter.
We have a very interesting witness tonight. I always try to bring the very best cases, the very best witnesses to this program, the very best that I can come up with. And this gentleman who is standing by in Idaho tonight is certainly one of those cases. The 20th of June, a Sunday night, about 11:15 p.m., this gentleman was standing in Seattle. Interestingly, not two blocks from where the National UFO Reporting Center is located. And he saw something go streaking through the perfectly cloudless, clear night sky that just shocked him from everything I can learn from him. Wonderful guy. He's got a very good, solid technical background. He's got good vision. Wonderful guy. And with that, I wonder if we could bring him on and just allow him to tell his own story tonight, Art.
Magic. Here is Jim. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Hi, Art. Hi, Peter.
Good evening, Jim, and thanks for being on tonight.
You betcha.
All right. What happened?
Well, it was June 20th, like Peter says. It was next to the longest day of the year. The conditions in Seattle were excellent. There were about, it was about 75 degrees. The skies were clear. The sky had a illumination that normally it doesn't have. The sun was, you know, we're at the higher latitude, so in Seattle, and the sky was lit lightly, and it was kind of a unique night, and we were out enjoying it, and I stepped back, and I tilted my head back to stretch, and I looked straight up, and about my 10 o'clock position, I saw this triangular shape, and it was a triangular craft moving quite rapidly. I saw it for about 4 seconds. It was absolutely stunning. It was beautiful in detail. It was triangular, black, with leading edge, and then an interior triangle that was a lighter gray with three lightly dim white lights within the gray part of the triangle, moving quietly, effortlessly, right up the I-5 corridor. We were about five blocks from the I-5 corridor, and it was moving in that direction from south to north. It absolutely just made the hair on the back of my neck stand up.
Why do you think you were not seeing a B-2, for example?
Oh, I know. This was not an aircraft of any kind that we know, because there was no sound. Most jet aircraft, no matter what they are, there's a jet engine strain from keeping that airplane in the air.
That's right.
You have thrust and you have intake noise and all this other mechanical noise going on around the jet. Plus, there's a fuselage. There's a design of a B-2. It looks like a bat. This is a perfect triangle. There was no mistaking it.
Sounds exactly like what I saw. I saw one myself very close up. Thank you very much. Probably my best sighting. And now here's a question. My sighting occurred in Little Pahrump, Nevada. And as it turned out, a number of other Pahrumpians also saw the triangle that I saw. It was reported laughingly as a C-130 by the Air Force on a secret mission.
Right.
But your sighting occurred in Seattle, where there are many, many, many people. And you would think that if you saw it, many, many others would have seen it.
Right. But going up the I-5 corridor, if you go up, there's five lanes both ways, and if it's traveling right, no one's looking up. They're looking straight ahead.
There we go.
So this object was not wasn't trying to hide itself. It was not in stealth form or anything. This was moving relatively quickly, but I saw a lot of detail in it. I was stunned by its I've been around cars and bikes and boats all my life. My dad and I are a couple of motorheads, and to see something like this was absolutely stunning.
What do you think you saw, Jim?
Well, I saw the report on the reports in the 1990s of Belgium, where NATO scrambled the F-16s after them, and this is exactly what I saw from that report in Belgium, Brussels, Belgium, where so many people saw it. It fits that description perfectly. It was not of this world, I can honestly say.
That's what I was after.
Yeah, there is no... I've been around B-52s, B-58 Hustlers, SR-71s, B-1s, B-2s. I know them all. And this was not one of ours.
Not one of ours.
Not one of ours, and not one of the Russians or one of the Chinese either. This thing was, to visually see this thing move effortlessly and quietly and silently, you know, up that I-5 corridor was absolutely incredible. It looked like a very, I can't describe. I was trying to describe this to my dad because he's an engineer, and we were trying to figure out exactly what this gray area within the machine looked like. And I said, the best I can describe it as is a swimming pool at night with the light on in this pool and all the other lights are off.
Right.
And you see a solid mass, but you can see kind of through it, and you notice there's something different about it. It's almost fluidic. It almost has a fluid look to it. And that's the way I can describe it, but it's absolutely stunning. It was beautiful aircraft, beautiful machine, whatever kind it was.
Peter, any other reports like Jim's?
Yeah, that's the interesting thing, Art, and it's part of the reason that I selected this case to bring to our audience tonight, because just a few minutes earlier, a gentleman who was down just south of Seattle, this is probably about 8 or 10 miles south of where Jim was standing at the time of his sighting, was just on the east side of Boeing Field, which is right on the west side of Interstate 5, south of downtown Seattle, and he saw a very bright object, as bright as a white burning phosphorus flare or a tungsten flare, go streaking across the sky, allegedly. This is what he reported and what he put in his written report, and suddenly do, from his vantage point, what appeared to be a right-angle turn somewhere near Boeing Field, somewhere over that area. This was just a few minutes before Jim's sighting, probably, about 10 miles, 8 or 10 miles north of Boeing Field. So there was also a sighting in Oregon a few minutes earlier. So we have one of those cases in which it appears that an object was not only just in an area where it was seen by several people, but it may have covered a fairly substantial distance in a matter of just a few seconds or at most a few minutes. It's a very dramatic case.
Jim, how has this affected what you believe now?
Well, you know, I've listened to UFO cases all my life, and I've listened to people, and people aren't crazy. They know what they see, and they report it. And I, you know, kind of always thought that maybe there was some other reason why they're here. And I don't know what that reasoning is, but I definitely saw something not of this world. And it has made a big difference in the way I look at things. My life hasn't changed any, but it sure opens your eyes.
Boy, it sure
makes
does.
You think.
It does all of that.
It puts a new sense of, you know, you kind of get revigorated with it. You kind of get excited that, you know, hey, there's something going on here, because I saw a machine that did something I've never seen a machine do and fly silently and effortlessly over the top of me. Under a B-58 Hustler at one of the air shows, and that thing rattled the ground 5 miles before it got to you and 10 miles when it passed you, and this thing just flew over the top of us just as quietly and effortlessly as can be.
Same as one I saw.
Yeah, you saw one similar to that then?
Yes, indeed. I would describe it as defying gravity. Flight requires a speed that would sustain something of that size in the air.
Right.
You know, with enough air going over
it. Right, airlift around the wings.
About 30 miles an hour or so. And
yeah.
Anyway, Jim, listen, I want to thank you for the report.
Oh, you bet.
Thank you for coming on the air, and you have a good night.
You betcha.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Peter.
Right. Good night, Jim. All right, so there you have it. There's yet another report, and there are millions and millions to go with what you just heard. So there's obviously something up there. There are craft above us flying, perhaps not our craft, although that's worth a discussion as well, and we'll have that. But the fact is, they're up there. What you're going to hear tonight from Peter Davenport is a way to identify the previously unidentifiable. That's right, he's got a way to detect UFOs.
To talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Coming up in a moment, Peter Davenport with perhaps a very dangerous idea. I've been doing this now for probably more years than I care to even recollect, and I know Peter Davenport has been doing the very same. And as interesting as it is to hear from somebody like Jim, it's sort of, gosh, I don't know, it's like millions of us, and I'm one of them, have seen these things. But we need to take, somehow, we need to take the next step. We need to go beyond droves of witnesses who have seen craft that are otherworldly. We need to figure out what the hell is going on. And in that regard, I think Mr. Davenport has come up with a workable and possibly dangerous idea. Remembering, Peter, you're going to have to explain this to people who may not know a lot about electronics. Let's do it.
You bet. It's really not that complicated, Art, and I am terribly pleased to be able to bring this idea to our audience tonight. Most of all, to have you on the program, because I'm going to call upon you to serve as a jury of one in assessing my proposal, principally given your background in radio, not just broadcast radio, but clearly you understand the physics of radio through your ham experience, through your technical training, and so on. So I'm going to call upon you tonight after we've completed discussing my proposal. This is a proposal that I first put forth at the MUFON symposium last weekend, and I was very pleased by the response it got. Many people came up to me just shocked by the fact that I appear to be proposing the application of an existing technology. I want to underscore at the beginning that I'm proposing no new technology here. As you well know from your experience in ham radio, skipping radio beams off objects up in the atmosphere is nothing new.
Not at all.
Ham radio operators have been doing that for a long time, the military and intelligence communities.
Well, in fact, to demonstrate that, Peter, we have what we call meteor scatter communications.
Yes.
And you wouldn't imagine that possible, but when meteors come streaking into the atmosphere, they ionize as they come in, and that allows you to bounce radio signals, brief and scattered as they may be, thousands of miles away. In other words, it leaves a trail, and as it comes in, you can bounce radio waves off that trail, and you can talk to people thousands of miles away. So, true.
Absolutely. There's nothing new or novel to this idea, and in fact, just about 5 years ago, I wrote and published an article in the MUFON Journal. It's a monthly publication put out by the Mutual UFO Network on this idea. And as I look back upon that article, Art, I just cringe because it was so primitive. I've come a long way since I wrote that article, and I'm pleased I have, because when I went back and read it in the course of preparing my article for the MUFON Symposium, I realized how much I did not know when I first wrote that article. Didn't know about reflecting beams off objects in the atmosphere. I didn't know about passive radar or what it was.
What was the premise of the original piece?
Well, I'll scroll back a little bit to share with our audience how all of this started. Just a few minutes ago, you were talking about the limitations of collecting still more eyewitness accounts of alleged UFO sightings.
Well, it's worth. In other words, we're going to continue to get them I guess, forever, or until we discover what it is that we have in our skies. They're going to just keep coming in. We need to go the next step.
I suspect that's the case. We've been collecting eyewitness reports of alleged UFO sightings easily since 1947, and in point of fact, it probably goes back to the World War II days when aviators over Europe were reporting these things that they called Foo Fighters that were accompanying their bombers on bombing raids over to the continent.
Yes, and we've had some of the most dramatic tape and sightings that a person could ask for involving, you know, people in control towers, police officers, firefighters, public service people, people who are supposed to know what they see and remember what they see to report accurately, thousands and thousands of them.
Absolutely.
So it's real. They're up there. Whatever in the hell they are, they're up there.
Yep. And we've had many of those people and many of those categories of people on this program, and I agree, we're going to continue collecting those reports ad infinitum. We've done that since 1947 at least. And I'm not sure that we've really made all that much progress from having collected this huge mound of UFO reports. Well, this occurred to me as early as January of 1995. In fact, I can tell you the exact date when I experienced this epiphany, or what I thought was an epiphany, I still do. It was the Friday before Martin Luther King weekend, January 1995, I was sitting around. I had served as director of the National UFO Reporting Center at that point for about 5 months. And I said to myself, you know, these eyewitness reports are very interesting, but they're really not moving us closer to any kind of resolution to this phenomenon. And I was just ruminating on this point, saying to myself, good heavens, the U.S. government must by now have trillions and trillions of dollars worth of hardware on the ground, in airplanes, mounted on satellites, orbiting the planet. I said to myself, if that is the case, why are we not getting more reports from the government of unambiguous UFO sightings using this equipment? Well, the government clearly has taken the position that they're not going to share any of this information with us mere citizens. And the next question I ask myself is, what could we UFO investigators do? What technology, what hardware could we use that would allow us to detect these UFOs without the benefit of an eyewitness to record the event and then report it? And it hit me like a bombshell, Art. I used to work in the venture investment industry back in the mid-1980s. And our company, or the company I was working for at the time, was approached by a company here in the Seattle area that made communication equipment that capitalized on their ability, as you were describing just a few minutes ago, to bounce a radio signal off of the ionized trail behind a meteor.
Uh-huh.
As you described, when a meteor comes screeching into the atmosphere, it generates a tube-shaped distribution of very, very hot gases. All that kinetic energy from its velocity is turned into thermal energy, and it heats up the atmosphere, just like a bolt of lightning or many other things. And I said to myself, aha, if there's equipment available that will allow us to skip a radio beam off the trail of a meteor, then we should be able to detect anything else in the atmosphere that reflects radio waves. Now, there can be many things that do that. Obviously, aircraft reflect radio waves. Satellites reflect them, even though they're outside the atmosphere. Some migratory birds can reflect them, and so on and so forth. But there's that category of other, those objects that cannot be ascribed to an aircraft or a meteor or any of those prosaic, mundane, terrestrial events, and those are what I am interested in.
And you would propose that you could see or identify these by what?
Well, you first have to detect these objects, and we'll talk about that. Detect it through a process known as the use of passive radar. Now, I'd like to pause on that for just a moment, that subject of passive radar, because I'm going to try my level best. It's really a very simple concept, but I'm going to try my level best to try to share with our audience some of the non-technical folks for whom radar is just nothing but a big mystery. But the type of radar that we have been accustomed to on this planet for the last 60 years is precisely that radar that we've all seen in those black and white 1950s vintage movies where a radar dish rotates on top of a tower and everybody's gathered around the scope in the control room looking for the blips that are recorded by this radar unit as it rotates and illuminates targets within range of the radar beam.
Which is not too magical. What you do is transmit a high-powered signal or pulse sometimes from a dish, and it strikes an object, metallic or otherwise, and according to how much reflectivity it has, it bounces
Absolutely.
Right back to you. And when it bounces back to you, you see a blip. So that's active
that
radar.
That is active radar. It's just like an analogy would be mounting a flashlight on your record player and turning the record player on, and this beam of light, which after all is magnetic, electromagnetic energy, it's in the visible spectrum or in the visible range of the electromagnetic spectrum, that is active radar. However, there's been a revolution in radar that has been allowed principally by the advent of computers, because passive radar, even though it does not require the radiation of a beam out to illuminate a target, it does require a great deal of computer capability to crunch a lot of data that is reflected from the atmosphere.
So let's talk about this. Passive radar, then, would be something that does not transmit a high energy anything. It doesn't transmit anything at all. It's the dish receiving only. But the question
exactly.
is, what's it receiving?
Well, what it is receiving, what people capitalize on, is the fact that when a radio transmitter, a radio antenna, broadcasts its radio signal up into the atmosphere, just as you and I are talking now, there are hundreds or thousands of antennas that are broadcasting their respective signals out into the atmosphere and beyond, and those radio signals propagate through the ether. They just keep going unless there happens to be something up in the atmosphere or beyond that would reflect that radio or television signal. If a satellite or a high-altitude aircraft is up there in the atmosphere or in low orbit, it will reflect that radio or television transmitted signal back down to the ground.
Bingo. So you're saying all these thousands of radio and TV transmitters transmitting very high power, mostly with circular polarization, which means it's just basically boom, going out, including up at the higher frequencies. Of course, that traverses the ionosphere. It does not bounce off the ionosphere. It just keeps going out into space unless it bounces off of something.
Exactly. And that bounce, that reflection, is what I'm interested in. For example, if we were to tune our radio, just a regular old FM receiver, the very same type of radio receiver that you have in an automobile, and you were to connect that to an antenna pointed, if I were to erect it here in Seattle, and I pointed the antenna, for example, in the direction of San Francisco and tuned my receiver to a radio station down in San Francisco, under normal circumstances, I would not be able to hear that transmitted signal coming out of San Francisco.
That's correct.
Because it is too far away. Most FM radio signals are high frequency, 30 megahertz or even higher. And consequently, I would hear nothing except for an occasional pop or squizzle or just a brief second or two period of time when I could hear that transmitted signal, which would be the result of the fact that that transmitted signal out of San Francisco is being momentarily reflected off something in the atmosphere.
Presumably, for example, a 777 aircraft could be flying at relatively high altitude, and if you were constantly tuned with a high-gain antenna, you would catch a couple of seconds, perhaps, of the San Francisco station as that aircraft got in the right position to be reflecting to you in Seattle.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely correct. But what I don't get is, while all of this is true so far, how do you begin to delineate between aircraft? A 777, for example, would give you the reflection we just talked about.
Yes.
How would you discern between, even with the best of passive radar, a 777, a meteorite, or a UFO?
Absolutely, and therein lies the problem. If you have just one station, just one antenna, that is listening to a station from over the horizon.
Yes.
And you hear these momentary pops and sizzles with your receiver.
Yes.
All you know from that information is that there is an open line of communication.
Right.
There's a reflection.
Right.
However, if you build more than just one receiver, two or preferably a minimum of three receivers tuned to the same station, what you can do, if all of those receivers are time-synchronized against a very, very accurate time clock or time signal, like what is available through the global positioning system, each one of those receivers on the ground can measure very, very accurately, one part in 10 to the 10th, for example, which is extremely accurate time, can measure when the signal struck its respective antenna. Once you have that information, you can start performing triangulation. That is, you can start calculating where the reflection point in the atmosphere must have been in order for the signal to strike those multiple antennas on the ground at the various times that they did. With this information in hand, you are suddenly able to calculate where the object was, perhaps what its velocity was, what its acceleration was, perhaps even the relative size of the target, and then you can start it to answer your question, how do you discriminate?
Yes.
Well, you can start discriminating between aircraft, between migratory birds. Sometimes even the atmosphere will reflect those signals back down. But if the object is moving at 10 or 20,000 miles an hour, as calculated by your receivers and your computer program, you know that it is not a duck. You know that it is not an aircraft. It is probably not a satellite. So you are receiving enough information by your antennas, by your receivers on the ground, to allow you to start discriminating between the different categories of objects that you might expect to reflect a signal off of. This is called passive radar. In point of fact, most of the major governments around the world, China, Russia, probably others, Britain as well, have started a transition from active radar, which has a number of inconveniences to it. If for one thing, it can be detected.
Sure.
And for military applications, the one thing you don't want to do with a radar unit is give away your location, or you don't want to alert your enemy to the fact that your radar signal is painting his aircraft. Or
actually, I believe a lot of radar installations get blown up when they paint aircraft.
Absolutely.
All right. Hold tight, Peter. We have only just begun. Stay right where you are.
I see trouble on the way.
There could be trouble on the way.
I see earthquakes and lightning. I see bad times today. Don't go around tonight. Well, it's bound to take
interested in the... With Art Bell. Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
And what you're hearing unfolding in front of your ears is an idea to identify the previously unidentifiable UFOs. Peter Davenport has a spectacular idea, and he's talking about passive radar, but it's actually active in a sense. The very radio station that you're listening to right now, some of you, the FMs, and certainly all the television stations, are transmitting huge amounts of energy, absolutely huge amounts of energy, straight up. A lot of them straight up. And that would be the active part of what Peter is saying we ought to be passively listening to and identifying. More in a moment. I'm going to tell you a very interesting little story that's going to bolster what Peter just said and make him think. As you know, I'm a ham operator and have been all my life. Well, occasionally, perhaps too frequently, some idiot will get on the radio and send out a false distress call or something of that magnitude. We've run into that over the years. And so I've had occasion to talk to the Federal Communications Commission field offices, the monitoring stations, and baby, they've come a long way. You see, it used to be that ham radio signals, like other shortwave signals, depend on bouncing off the ionosphere and then returning to Earth for communications. Now, the problem has always been in identifying the whereabouts of somebody, for example, transmitting a distress call, false or otherwise. The FCC has come a longer way than they will admit in being able to identify the source of a signal. They're now all computerized, and they're using a form of what Peter's talking about. And while I can't tell you everything I know, I can tell you they have some sophisticated equipment that even though a signal bounces off the ionosphere with disparate receiving locations and computers, the Federal Communications Commission within seconds can identify within square feet where transmission is originating. It's incredible what they can do. Word of warning to the wise out there who would do idiotic things like that. They can identify the location down to a matter of feet very rapidly, much more rapidly than they're willing to talk about. So that's a kind of passive identification of location that we're talking about. Not exactly the same thing, but it's very close in a lot of ways. Peter?
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I'm very pleased to have that information, Art. We did the same thing over in Germany when I was stationed over there with the U.S. Army Security Agency. We used to perform direction-finding functions, something you're quite familiar with.
Sure.
Essentially, you just measure the direction that radio signal is coming from, and if you have two or more receiver stations, each of which is doing the same thing, measuring the azimuth or the direction to the source of the radio signal, you can determine the location of the transmitter.
Now, while that is true, Peter, for ground line of sight type things, it would not be true for a signal coming from the ionosphere because of the fact that it bounces off the ionosphere, it scatters, and in the old days they couldn't find the location of something bouncing off the ionosphere. But I'm telling you, Peter, it's changed, and now not only can they tell you where it's coming from, but within square feet of where it's coming from. Now, how they do that,
yeah.
I don't know, but I have a feeling that it relates to what you're talking about.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. In fact, I'm not surprised that they're doing that. I discovered that the U.S. Navy is using passive radar to track all of those millions and millions of objects that are orbiting our planet using a form of passive radar.
Sure.
In fact, in my paper, which I wrote for the MUFON proceedings of the symposium that was held in Denver a week ago, I address the U.S. Navy Naval Space Surveillance System. It is referred to in the trade as the FENCE. It's a facility that we hear about relatively infrequently, certainly much less frequently than we hear about the BMUSE line up in the northern reaches of Canada, the ballistic missile early warning system that was designed to protect us from intruding missiles from the other side of the planet.
Peter, do you think the FENCE is using passive radar?
Absolutely.
In other words, all these electronic signals bounced, their frequencies are known, and all the rest of it. And as long as you have that information and enough computer power, then something like the FENCE works. And
yes,
they can literally watch through this soup of noise that's thrown up. And they can watch these objects pass through the FENCE.
Absolutely. And the reason that I believe the U.S. government knows about the UFO phenomenon is, one, several of their employees once told me they did, but even more important than that is because of the FENCE. I'd like to take just a minute to describe for our listeners what the FENCE is. It is a series of transmitters that are located along a straight line along the southern tier of the United States, positioned on a straight line, more or less, that stretches from San Diego east to Fort Stewart, Georgia. There are three transmitters along that line, and those transmitters broadcast a signal straight up using what is known as a phased array antenna. So all of that radio energy is concentrated in a very, very narrow window of space. And the value of that is that whenever a satellite or any kind of space debris flies through that narrow fan of broadcast electromagnetic radiation, the object will reflect that signal back down to ground.
In essence, that's active radar.
It is. The distinction between active and passive is sort of blurry, as you suggest, Art.
Yeah.
But in this case, it is a bistatic or multistatic radar in the sense that the transmitters and receivers are not necessarily located at the same location. They're in different locations, and there are multiple receivers that detect the reflected signal from a single reflection point in orbit. And what the Navy does with this facility, essentially, is keep track of everything that orbits the planet. Satellites, astronauts' gloves, you name it, they can detect it. And the signal that they broadcast is so strong, and presumably their receivers so sensitive, that it is reputed that the Navy can detect a target approximately the size of a grapefruit that is out a distance of 15,000 nautical miles above the surface of the planet Earth. In other words, they can detect an object the size of a grapefruit at a distance equal to 2 times the diameter of the planet Earth. So you know this is a very effective system. And the Navy has to do that because we cannot afford to allow somebody to slip something in to American airspace. It could be a piece of discarded space debris, but then again, it could be some kind of grievous weapon that we don't want penetrating our airspace. So the Navy has been using this system for at least 30 years that I can account for. It may go back even 4 decades, and it is what tells me that the U.S. government, if these things that we call UFOs are real, these things that you and I have been talking about with countless witnesses now for nine and almost a decade, if the government knows that they are real, it is because they have hardware like the fence that allows them to detect these objects on a regular basis.
So they have to know. They have to know. That's all there is to it. They have to know.
Of course. In fact, about 5 years ago, I called the command center for the U.S. Navy fence. This was one of the most amusing telephone conversations I've had in a decade, Art.
How so?
I called them up. I identified them myself, told them who I was, which I always do. I don't act in a stealth mode, if you will. Called them up and talked to the switchboard, and the very nice young woman said, "This is the U.S. Navy facility in Virginia that controls the fence." Told them what I wanted to do, told them I wanted to talk to one of their technical sorts, an engineer preferably. I got a young woman on the line. She was, I believe, a lieutenant commander. I explained who I was, what I was seeking, and I wanted confirmation as to what they were detecting with the fence. And you can imagine her reaction. Here it is, a top-secret facility. A half-baked UFO investigator is calling from Seattle,
yes,
for all intents and purposes, inquiring whether they are picking up UFOs with their facility.
Why not? I mean, you just never know. Why not pick up the phone and give it a shot?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I'm just that type of person. I've done the same thing with the Air Force, and I take the position that these people are our public servants.
Uh-huh.
Now, I'm not so naive as to assume that they're going to give me any information. After all, it could cost them their jobs. It could cost them their freedom. They have taken security oaths, secrecy oaths. Mm-hmm. They cannot reveal any of this information.
So how did the call go?
It was short. It was very short.
Yes.
She said, "Mr. Davenport, I appreciate your call," but she said, "I am very uncomfortable even just being on the telephone with you, no matter what we talk about." And she said, "I am going to have to terminate this conversation right now." And she did. And she just hung up the phone.
Mm-hmm.
That conversation didn't last more than 20 or 30 seconds.
Uh-huh.
And what she was telling me, for all intents and purposes, is that they probably are detecting these things we call UFOs, because if they were not, why would they be hesitant to talk to an American citizen? After all they are doing, or would be doing in that instance, would be detecting orbiting satellites and space debris that has been launched over the last 40 or 45 years of space exploration.
Yeah.
And the fence, it is my understanding, and there's some very nice websites on the Internet. You can go to Google and type in U.S. Navy space surveillance, and you will see the photographs of these facilities that are stretched in a straight line across the southern United States.
Well, if you'll excuse the pun, that's a private fence, Peter.
Yeah.
You see, and so what we're really talking about tonight is an effort, I would presume, to get people together, people who know computers, people who know this technology, and put together our own fence.
Absolutely.
Now, you see, Peter, I see a lot of potential problems with your idea, not technical problems, because it will work. What I see here is trouble for Peter.
Yes.
And it's because this private fence is detecting, for example, some things that we have up there that we don't talk about, both in and out of the atmosphere. And so a fence, whether it would be the private one or one that we might put together, well, I shouldn't say we, you and your friends might put together.
Thank you for that, Art. Thank you for that volunteer service.
That we would see things that we're not supposed to see. And of course, the next question is, how much detail, if this system works that you're talking about, how much detail might we, with our fence, be able to see? Let's get right down to it.
Yes, yes. Well, it was a problem for me before tonight, before this broadcast. This, for all intents and purposes, this program is my dead man switch. Because now the word is out. I presume we have a few listeners on the line tonight who are following this. In fact, I would be surprised, Art, if there were not some senior military officers who have already picked up the telephone to talk to one another and try to figure out what kind of damage control the government might be able to perform on this. Because this proposal that I've come forth with, that I presented at the MUFON Symposium last weekend, is a threat to the government in several respects. I agree with you 100%. There are almost certainly objects that the U.S. military and intelligence communities have up in our atmosphere that they do not want us mere citizens to know about.
I'd lay money on it.
Drones, for example?
Drones, a lot of drones. Let me ask again, Peter, what kind of resolution with a fairly sophisticated system could we expect?
Yeah. It's a very good question, and I will take a stab at it, but I will point out to you and our listeners that this is more your bailiwick, Art, than it is mine. I am a biologist. I'm trained as a biochemist and a geneticist, and you can imagine how much apprehension I have talking to somebody like you who knows radio backwards and forwards, talking to somebody like you about the technical aspects of radio.
Well, I know some. Look, Peter, I'm no genius in the area. I know some. I worked in microwave. I'm a ham operator. So, yeah, I have some background, but not a genius in the area. And I have no idea what kind of resolution.
Yeah. Well, I think we can get a grasp on this. We can put a handle on it when we stop to consider for a moment that the U.S. Navy is able to reputedly detect something the size of a grapefruit at a distance of about 16 or 17,000 statute miles.
Uh-huh. But they're dealing with their own active system in that case. We're proposing using existing very strong signals and computer power to begin to resolve, I wonder how much. I mean, that's the big question.
That's the big question, and there are many variables here, the variables being the frequency of the signal you're using, the power of the signal, the amount of noise, the bandwidth, all of those criteria have a bearing on what kind of target you can detect, we will be able to detect with this proposed system. But one of the scenarios that I have proposed in my paper is not using commercial radio or television FM signals, but rather using the transmitted signal that the Navy is generating today.
Using the active portion of their fence.
Using their fence, we build
receivers. Yeah.
And when I say build, that is almost an overstatement. All you have to do is connect a receiver with a cable to an antenna, and point it upwards and listen for the reflected signal.
Yes.
From anything that might be up above, that might penetrate that fan of electromagnetic energy.
Yes, exactly. Do you have any idea, Peter, what frequencies are in use?
The Navy transmits a CW wave,
yes,
or a continuous wave signal, at 216.98 megahertz.
Yeah, that's the military band.
Very high frequency.
But not at all impossible, just VHF.
Exactly. But the power of what they transmit is the interesting part. They pump out 768 kilowatts of energy, and I don't know if that's peak energy, root mean square energy, or what it is, but it is a whopping strong signal.
Oh, it absolutely is. Fascinating. All right, hold it right there. Why do I have this feeling that we're headed for a really rocky part of the rapids here, right now, with Peter Davenport? He's right. They're already transmitting it. All we would need would be receivers and the computer power to tell us what we're looking at. Trouble. Trouble ahead. I'm Art Bell.
Talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Well, well, well. 216.980 megahertz. Is that right? Not exactly impossible, ladies and gentlemen. As a matter of fact, during the break, I took the opportunity to dial up 216.980 megahertz, and you hear that? Listen carefully. You hear that? I don't know if you can hear that signal or not, but there's a signal there. You're listening to 216.980, which is up in the military band, and that's as received here in the desert. Now, I don't know what I'm hearing, but there is obviously some form of a signal there. I wonder if it is the fence. Peter Davenport of the UFO Reporting Center in Seattle proposing a radical idea that we utilize the fence. The same thing that allows us to watch even little tiny objects in orbit. Objects above us, a transmitted signal, he says 216.980, transmitted by one of three transmitters comprising the fence. And Spooky in Enterprise, Alabama writes, "Hey Art, if Peter's in jail by morning, we'll know we're on to something." Well,
I don't know about that, but you're definitely on to something. So you're proposing we use the active resource of the military's fence and put together our own receiving stations, therefore being able to see literally everything that's in the air that passes by.
That is exactly what I'm proposing, Art. There are a number of scenarios that I outline in my paper, but that is the one that I like most, principally because the signal that is transmitted is unwavering. In other words, it is a continuous wave, a sine wave.
Mm-hmm.
We know what it is like when it goes up. And one of the things with passive radar that you have to do is compare the reflected signal that comes from your target, compare that reflected signal with the original transmitted signal. By doing that, you can extract all sorts of information about your target.
Yes, and here's where the computer power comes into play.
Absolutely.
So can it literally, based on the multiple reflections and the computer power, draw us a picture of what is interrupting that signal?
My presumption is it can. Again, I would like to emphasize for our audience that I am a biologist, for heaven's sakes. Although I must say that I am flabbergasted that nobody in the UFO community has thought of doing this in the past, because no matter whether our audience has understood some of the technical points that principally you have made during this program, irrespective of that, the concept is relatively simple. As you pointed out, just sitting and listening for any reflected radio signals that come back down to the ground level from our atmosphere or beyond.
Okay, what it is going to require, though, having the signal there is part of the battle. Being able to receive it's part of the battle. Being able to interpret what you get is most of the battle. And it's going to require some sort of very sophisticated software to begin to understand what we receive. How would you propose we acquire that?
Yeah. Well, in point of fact, it already exists. There are a number of passive radar systems that are in operation. Interestingly, one of the probably the more well-known systems is within 20 minutes walk of the National UFO Reporting Center. It's based at the University of Washington in the Electrical Engineering Department, and they use this system. They listen for a reflected signal that is transmitted on the east side of the Cascade Mountains. It reflects off the ionosphere, and they image the shape of the ionosphere using the reflected signal. So this system already exists.
By the way, those would be some people you could call.
Absolutely, and in fact, I've been in touch with them for well nigh on 2 years now.
Oh.
And they are not, I would like to emphasize, because these people are professors of electrical engineering here, they point out very unambiguously that they have absolutely no interest in UFOs, none whatsoever. What they are doing is, because they are public employees at the University of Washington, they are helping this crazy, wild-eyed UFO investigator who has this sort of half-baked idea, and sharing within their time constraints, sharing with that UFO investigator enough information to allow us to start discussion of how we're going to build our own system. That is, I have to be very careful in how I phrase this. but that is where we stand. And going back to one of your statements several minutes ago, the government, what is its role in all of this is going to be? I can share one very interesting aspect of all of this. On the 6th of July, a few days after MUFON had posted the abstract to my paper,
mm-hmm.
on the website where they were advertising the symposium in Denver, I got a very interesting telephone call from a gentleman who described himself as a technical sort who works for an intelligence agency on the east coast of the United States. And I can only but paraphrase. I don't remember his exact words, Art, but one of the more interesting, one of the more surprising telephone calls I've received in my life. I think I'm comfortable with that statement. He said, "Mr. Davenport, a copy of the abstract of your paper has just been forwarded to me by a former colleague of mine who is now retired from the U.S. intelligence community."
Mm-hmm.
In point of fact, I would suspect that this retired individual is listening to this program as we speak.
Probably.
He's a regular listener to Coast. This gentleman who had called from the East Coast said that he was calling because the field that I was proposing, namely passive radar, had been an interest of his, a professional interest on behalf of this intelligence organization for, I gather, something on the order of 30 years. And he seemed very interested in what I was proposing. Very interesting guy, very pleasant to talk with, very sharp. I presume that he is a PhD-level researcher for one of our intelligence organizations.
Do you think he was probing, trying to find out how far down this trail you had come, or sort of just trying to tell you you're on an interesting road, or, you know, the purpose of the call?
Yes. I think the latter, Art, principally because his son, who appears to be following in the father's footsteps in technology, apparently has already built one of these systems, at least a primitive version of it, of a passive radar, and this young lad is still a high school student. So I think he may have been calling because he knew what his son was doing, and suddenly he's confronted with this abstract from my paper proposing that we do exactly the same, and he's given me a great deal of information. He's directed me. We've had a number of correspondences since that first conversation on the 6th of July, and he's pointed me in the direction of a number of people who have been working in passive radar for many, many decades. Interestingly, this individual also pointed out that the first patent for a passive radar system was applied for in England in, this is shocking to me, the year 1927 A.D.
Huh.
So people have been thinking about this
for a long
idea.
Time. For a long time. But,
for a long time.
But they haven't escalated to the point where they, for example, as you were doing, suggest that we actually put our own system together based on the transmissions conveniently made for us by the fence. What would you need, what do you need, Peter, to make this idea happen? You need volunteers? Do you need people who write software? Do you need people who might already have the software to put it in your hand? What do you need?
Well, if anybody has been working on this type of technology, please get in touch with me because I would like to know where you are with your technology, with your project, and how what they have done might be of assistance to us. Now, we have to build a relatively specialized system, although it is my understanding that the passive radar system that works at the University of Washington, with relatively little adaptation, then that is principally writing of code, as you correctly suggest.
Yes.
You need an algorithm and a substantial body of code to handle all of this veritable torrent of information that is going to be coming down to your antennas. But we have put together a small team of electrical engineering and physicists who are very interested in this project. Frankly, I cannot be much help in that domain for reasons that I've already explained during this program. But the real message here, Art, the message that I find so terribly exciting is that this project, if it is successful, and there is no reason it shouldn't be successful, is going to take away from the U.S. government the monopoly that it has enjoyed heretofore for the last 57 years since the dawning of the age of modern ufology. We are offering, in fact, threatening may not be too strong a term here, this project will take away the U.S. government's monopoly with regard to its ability to detect UFOs, not just in the atmosphere, but for thousands of miles out from the surface of the Earth. That is what I find interesting, because it is going to allow us.
But they're going to find it threatening.
They are.
They absolutely are. I mean, it's not something you can ignore. What you have proposed, I believe, to be possible, but, gee, Peter, they're just not going to like it at all.
They're not going to enjoy it. It's going to cause them to lose a lot of sleep, I believe, because we are going to catch them. I believe UFOs are real. That's no surprise to our audience tonight. Anyone who's listened to any of the many, many programs that you and I have done and programs I've done with George on Coast to Coast, it is a given from my vantage point that these things that we call UFOs are real.
Yes, but so are experimental aircraft, military experimental aircraft. A lot of them fly here where I live, as you well know. And those are real, too. And you're going to see those as clearly as you're going to see any UFO, and they're just going to hate that. So
they're not going to like it. It's going to cause a lot of stomach acid to be generated in Washington, D.C., there's no doubt about it. And I suspect by the time we get to Patriot Act 5, or whatever is in our future with this government, that they're going to figure out some weasel speak that allows them to make the ownership of an FM receiver illegal. And, of course, they're going to tax it as well. But the foundation of passive radar is that it is passive. If we were transmitting a signal,
then they'd have control of it.
Then they would have control.
But they're transmitting the signal.
Yes. We are only sitting and listening to it.
Yes.
And if they get somehow exercised over that...
Don't rule out the possibility. Listen, they have made it illegal to listen to certain things, cellular conversations, for example, and other bands. They've made it illegal to even listen. It doesn't seem like they could do that in America, but they have done it.
Yes, I know. It's going to be very much more difficult for them, though, to make it illegal to sit and tune your receiver to a continuous wave, a sine wave coming out of Lake Kickapoo, Texas, or any of the other transmitter sites across the United States. It is going to be very interesting, Art, to see what the response of our government is to this proposed project. Because if we ufologists are correct, and there's very little remaining doubt in my mind but what we are, contrary to what our skeptics say, UFOs are real, and the project that you and I have been discussing here for the last hour or so is going to give us the unambiguous resolution to that question. And it's going to, if the government has been lying to us, and my impression is that it has, it is going to show to the American people that the American government has been withholding the truth from them for over half a century on perhaps the biggest scientific awakening that has occurred in the history of man. That is what is going to happen. And I agree with you, they're not going to like it.
If we had, Peter, the records available to us of not just what they've identified that belongs to us or the Russians or the Chinese or whoever's got stuff up there, and we had the records and we could see, for example, how many times they've recorded objects traversing the atmosphere at 20,000 miles an hour or better, whatever, I wonder how many there would be. I wonder how big the list would be of things that they know are here but can't do anything about.
Yes. I would be very surprised, Art, based on what I know and based on what I've learned over the last 9.5 years. This project goes back 9.5 years from January of 1995, since before I ever appeared on Dreamland or Coast to Coast. That's how long I've been working on this project.
Gotcha. I know you've been talking to me about it for quite some time, and I think I served up some of the same warnings to you on the phone that I am right now.
Absolutely.
Knowing that it would work. I mean, I know your idea will work, and that alone makes it dangerous. Ideas can be dangerous.
Yes, they can.
And I hope we still live in a country where the free flow of ideas, even perhaps slightly threatening ones, is still allowed.
I hope so, too, Art. And my reaction to that statement is, if we discover that we don't live in such a country, then we're going to have to force the issue with this government and remind them that those people who work in Washington, D.C., sequestered though they may be within the Beltway, nevertheless are our public servants. They work for us. We provide their salary and their medical care and their retirement so they can serve us, not the reverse.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this project, once we get it off the ground, will be a very interesting litmus test of our government.
Yes.
It will show to us, I think blatantly, it'll be wide open. It will show to us what position this government is going to take on the free access to information.
Well, it's already being challenged in other areas. Peter, for example, the Russians will take satellite photographs for you of anything you ask for if you pay them enough money. They will take pictures, and they're up on the web, of Area 51 and stuff like that. So government security by technology has already been compromised in some areas.
Yes.
And but this is a real big one, and it's going to be interesting. You know, I have one level of technical capability, and you have one, and then our listeners out there, well, maybe they can shoot some holes in this idea. Maybe there are some holes that I don't see, but I've known about this, folks, for quite a while, have had discussions with Peter, and I'm afraid I think it will work. I really think it will work. Now, if any of you are able to shoot holes in this idea, that would be intellectual holes, please, then proceed to do so. I would like to hear from you in the next hour as we open up phone lines. If there's any holes that we're missing, Peter, I think we should hear from the audience whether they think it's a good idea, a bad idea, an anti-American idea. You know,
absolutely. I would love to hear what their response is to this, and I'd like to know whether they understand the concept that you and I have been talking about here. There's really nothing difficult to it.
Right, exactly right. All right, well, that's what we're going to do when we get back. Stay right where you are. Peter Davenport of the UFO Reporting Center in Seattle, Washington, is my guest. I'm Art Bell, right here in the middle of the night, which is exactly where we belong. This is Coast.
Bell. Call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast
and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Kind of like Kodachrome, actually. All those wonderful colors and that great detail and that resolution. What Peter Davenport, my guest tonight, has recommended is utilizing the military's fence. Those very powerful signals they transmit up on 216.980 so they can observe space junk, even little pieces of space junk, and know exactly where everything is and every aircraft and type of whatever that traverses our atmosphere. And since they're transmitting that, why simply not set up some receive stations, get the right software together, and see everything the military sees? And so now we're going to see what you think of the idea. On the one hand, it's going to work. The idea is definitely workable. On the other hand, should it be done? I'm turning this over in my mind, and on the one hand, what Peter proposes is presently completely legal. Completely legal. And on the one hand, it would certainly do as he is suggesting it would do. It would identify unidentified aircraft, at least to certainly a pretty good degree. In other words, we'd be able to know if there are UFOs out there. But, you know, we'd also see U.S. military craft, a civilian, all kinds of craft. We would see everything that is happening. And on the other hand, 25,000 miles an hour would identify it as certainly something that we don't think we have right now. But we would have to be able to delineate between the usual and the unusual. And other than speed, Peter, I wonder what would there be a fine enough detail to delineate between the various types of aircraft, right down to that?
My suspicion is that there would be enough information. It just depends on how complex the algorithm is that you're prepared to write. Lockheed Martin is building a system that they call Silent Sentry. And the objective of this system is to serve as an air defense radar system. And clearly they would want to be able to distinguish between different types of aircraft, which we can do today, it's my understanding, with existing onboard radar in both fighters and AWACS. They can tell you what type of airplane they're looking at by the unique signal that's reflected by it, the signal that's reflected off the fan blades. They can tell all sorts of things, I understand. I believe that if we design the system correctly, we will be able to get all sorts of information about the type of target that we're looking at, the size, perhaps even the shape, certainly its flight path, its velocity, its acceleration, and everything we will need to distinguish it from just typical prosaic aircraft.
All righty then. Let's see what people think. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Peter Davenport. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Susan, and I'm calling through radio station KMOP. And my consideration is that if we're detecting these objects, what if they've got a stealth cover on them? Because normally passive surveillance means you're looking at something like thermal transmission by the body, sound transmission, magnetic anomaly, chemical transmission. So if you've got a stealth cover on this thing, you're not going to see anything if you send a signal out to it. But you may be able to detect it with quantum physics, as they're doing now in the optical astronomy, where they have a super-cooled CC detector, and then they're using a quantum waveguide. And that would allow you to detect something that wouldn't be detectable otherwise.
All right. Peter, a pretty good question. Suppose you're dealing with stealthy type things.
Absolutely.
Certainly the return is not going to be strong enough, or when it passes over the fence, is it strong enough?
Yeah. The caller raises a very, very good question that I skipped over earlier in the program, and that is, the first consideration is, do UFOs reflect radio signals? And we know from some radar visual cases that we have on file, in fact, I've got two cases for which I've received radar from the FAA, which clearly show a UFO tracking an airliner.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that at least some of these UFOs reflect electromagnetic radiation, and that's all we need. Now, one point I would add to that is that if these UFOs engage in some kind of active, stealthy application, the interesting part of a passive radar system is they would never know what frequency or what the source of the transmitted signal is that somebody with a passive radar listening complex would be tuned to. So they wouldn't know which frequency they would have to avoid or which frequency they would have to squelch. So it would be pretty tricky for them to know a priori which of the signals, and of course there are millions of radio signals that are emanating out from the surface of the Earth, anywhere from the U.S. Navy fence down to individual cell telephone transmitters. So the caller raises a very good question, but I don't think it would be a major problem.
Okay. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Peter Davenport. Hello.
Are we going east of the Rockies?
Yes.
Well, hello, Art. Good to hear your voice again.
Thank you.
Jay, and Lake Charles coming to you on KAOK tonight.
Yes, sir.
Before I give you something to ponder, just a quick question. The SPENCE system that the United States has in place, I would assume that other nations, including rogue nations around the world, have a similar system. Am I correct?
I believe you are correct. In fact, the Russians and Chinese are working on the very technology that we are discussing during this program. So my answer is yes.
Well, what throws me, with as many countries that would love to just say that, you know, the United States government consists of a bunch of liars, they lie to their own people, if these fences can detect these things, which, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say that UFOs only visit the United States, couldn't they say, you know, we have these images, they're all over the place, it's been going on for 50 years. It seems to me that someone else, as a put-down to the U.S. government, would say they've known about these. It's just another lie, and we would hear about it on the Internet or somewhere.
Now, isn't that interesting? Peter?
That day is arriving, and I have thought along the very same lines that our caller has proposed. Yes, indeed, this day is coming. I suspect that there will be a competition between governments once the cat is out of the bag and everybody knows that everybody else is using passive radar as opposed to active radar. The question becomes, who is going to be the first one to step forward and say the king is wearing no clothing? That is a very interesting point. It could even be our group. One of the complicating factors in what our caller proposes is that many countries do not want to even reveal that they are using passive radar
right.
in an air defense capacity.
Right. I can see that clearly. To make any charge, particularly over an issue like this, would reveal their capability.
Yep.
So that's something in intelligence you don't do.
Yep. Exactly.
Uh-huh. Okay. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Peter Davenport. Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, Art, this is Steve in San Diego, listening on the big one, KOGO, 600 AM.
Yo, Steve.
This is one of the best shows you've ever had on. It's finally glad to hear Peter cut loose like this. I have never heard him. He sounds like Richard C. tonight. You need to get the two of them together on this whole thing. But as far as the systems, as what he's talking about and so on, we already have that. The U.S. Navy by itself, in the reverse, if you will, with the VLF, underseas, and that kind of thing. Do you think we not see all of these things detected one way or another?
Well, the question, though, is whether we know we have these things, but should we, as in, I don't know, as in UFO organizations or concerned people getting together, should citizens have these things?
That's absolutely. But we have the technology, just as you are talking about this evening, to receive the signals and
sure.
observe these things.
Sure.
The technology is there. The U.S. military and intelligence are already using that. They know. They're just not telling us.
All right. All right. Thank you very much. So somebody who thinks that you should proceed. I do think that proceeding from this point, Peter, has its dangers. And how much thought have you given to that?
I've given a lot of thought to it, Art, and it doesn't concern me in the least for any of a number of reasons. The first one is, for example, I doubt that I am at any greater risk than, for example, a law enforcement officer is exposed to in a typical work day, or a firefighter, or a professional driver, a bus driver, a taxi driver, or somebody who steers Boeing 737s for a living. There's always a finite amount of risk. You can never get away from it. But I would say that the risk that I might have been exposed to tomorrow is considerably less
than today.
Than today.
Well, all right. Do you want volunteers, and if so, in what category?
Well, we're not set up to use volunteers yet. What we would like to do is get one system working,
mm-hmm.
and that's what we're working on here in Seattle. Again, I have a team of three very talented people together with access to information at the University of Washington.
Oh, so you're underway with this already.
Underway in a sense. We have not built a system, but the building of a system hinges principally on the writing of the code and then testing, run a beta test site, and get it up and running. The interesting thing about that is, and I discussed this at the very end of my presentation last Saturday in Denver, is that what I would like to see is a series of these stations. And given that a station can reach out to a range of perhaps 1,000 miles, points out how large an area a single station can cover. If it has 3 or 4 antennas pointed in opposite directions, it can cover a circular area 2,000 miles in diameter. Now, there's a lot of stuff in that airspace that would create, that would generate a great deal of information that would have to be handled by your computer.
That's right.
But it underscores how relatively few stations we need to cover the entire continental United States.
An interesting Fast Blast actually inquires whether, for example, you might utilize the kind of processing capability that SETI at Home utilizes. In other words, to get so much processing capability, you farm it out.
Yes. That is a possibility. In fact, I just responded to perhaps the same source of that query. It is a very, very good idea, but what we would like to be able to do is process the information coming into our antennas on a real-time basis,
mm-hmm.
so that when something streaks across the sky, we are looking at it
right away
on our instrumentation. We don't have to farm it out to 100 people who are on vacation with computers, having to wait for them to get back from vacation to return the processed data.
Gotcha.
There's one other interesting aspect to all of this, and that is the possible use of theodolites, that is, gimbaled cameras. Now, there's a great deal of engineering in this proposal, and it is vastly beyond anything that I am capable of, but I throw it out as a concept here. I am to the UFO field or UFO detection field what H.G. Wells was to exploration of the moon. I am throwing out a concept here that I've been working on for a long time. In fact, just about a year and a half ago, I took my first ever, and I hope last ever, electrical engineering course at the University of Washington on radar.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a biologist, a genetics engineer, taking a graduate-level electrical engineering course. I was out of my league, but it did teach me a great deal about radar. And one of the things that I would like to do, if and when we get one of these systems up and running, is to run the feed out to a theodolite or a gimbaled camera such that when we detect an object, we can focus a camera on it and try to get video or still photos of the target.
No, it makes all the sense in the world. Once you know where the target is, then with a gimbaled camera, it goes right to it and tracks for as long as you're able to track the trajectory of that object. No, it makes all the sense in the world.
Yep. That's what they did with missiles back in the 50s and 60s. We've all seen those cameras that tilt back very rapidly when the missile is launched from its launch pad.
Now, where's, you know, I mean, this is going to take some money.
Yep.
As well as organization. And where is that coming from?
Yeah. That's part of the problem that we have not figured out, Art. You know, let me tell you a little story about that money. I have made this presentation to what we are technically capable of doing to four billionaires. That's billionaires with a B as in boy.
Yes.
In two cases, I have submitted the idea twice to the same billionaire, and in one of those cases, I've actually sat with the individual on two occasions and described in detail what we could do. To date, we have received not a penny for this project, not a single penny.
However, there must have been some unusual level of interest, or you would not have been given audience.
A great deal of interest. They actually sat up and said, "What? You're able to detect UFOs with this system unambiguously, objectively, and without the aid of an eyewitness, a human eyewitness."
Right.
And that is what we are talking about tonight. And I said, yes, that is the case, and we need money. The money will go principally for some hardware, although if people would like to see how simple a passive radar receiver is, they can go to our website, ufocenter.com. I've posted my article there. It shows photographs of what a passive radar system, a simple one, looks like. And it's really no more complicated than a Beijing radio, for heaven's sake.
That part of it, right. But,
it is very simple.
But
the cost is, the bulk of the cost will be in the writing of the hardware, testing the system, things such as that. And I cannot, in this program, give a detailed analysis of what that will all amount to, but it will be substantial. But the one thing that I find very unusual is that we have billionaires across this country who are pouring millions and tens of millions and hundreds of millions of dollars into the SETI project. Search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
No, this makes sense as an investment. Do you think you're talking about tens of thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions? Just give me a ballpark.
I would say between tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands for a first-class operation and engineering team.
Not much, really?
Not much at all. It is a shoestring operation, and it's principally because passive radar is so much simpler than an active radar system. You don't have to generate a transmitted wave or signal.
Mm-hmm.
You just sit and listen and process what you hear over your radio.
Mm-hmm.
And you need an intelligent system in the sense that all of your receivers are time-synchronized. That is very easily done, I am told, using the GPS signal.
No, all of this is doable. The question is whether it would violate national defense in to such degree that they would take action to stop it, Peter. That's something you really have to ask yourself.
Yeah. Well, if they take that action, I hope our government hasn't gotten to that stage. I really do, Art. I think all of us do. But it is a possibility, in which case we move the operation offshore.
Oh.
Very simple to do, I think. It would take some effort, but it could be done. And I think now that the seed of the idea is planted in the minds of many, many listeners,
yes,
to coast, it's going to be very difficult to put this wildfire out.
That's right. That's how it works. Little fire gets to be a big fire from the high desert. This is Coast to Coast AM with ideas.
Talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
So, what do you think? Good idea? Well, yes. An idea that should be grown from its current seedling point and actually made operational? That kind of a good idea? That's what we're talking about. Well, I would think that the results of the airing of this idea tonight could range all the way from absolutely no reaction at all to, Mr. Davenport, come out. We need to talk to you. Actually, they need to talk to you in Washington, somewhere in that range anyway. What do you think, Peter?
I don't anticipate that that's going to be a problem, but it's very difficult to know for sure, Art. Again, going back to the point we were discussing, we're simply setting up receivers to listen to the atmosphere.
Yes.
The government's going to have to bend over backwards to try to convince a jury or convince the American people or a Congress that this is inappropriate. I think our time has come. I'm very excited about this project. I've been excited about it for over 9 years.
Why have you waited until now?
I have not. In fact, when I wrote my article in 1999 and submitted it to the MUFON Journal for publication, it was in their 30th anniversary issue, November of 99. After it hit the stands, I was braced for what I expected to be a torrent of response from the UFO community. Essentially, people saying, "What? You're proposing a system that is going to allow us mere UFO investigators to detect UFOs without having to go hat in hand to the government requesting this information?" I said, yes. Well, I was expecting that response. I was flabbergasted, Art. It was 9 weeks after the publication of that article that I received my first query on this proposed system. That was all 5 years ago. I've been talking about this since 1995. I've met, as I mentioned earlier, with billionaires seeking funding. I've met with engineers seeking their assistance. And I'm absolutely flabbergasted that it has taken me so long to captivate the interest of the UFO community and people with technical backgrounds. That points up, I think, the value, one of many values of Coast to Coast, the ability to get a novel idea like this. And frankly, I think that what you and I have been talking about on this program for the last hour and a half, approximately, is revolutionary for reasons I've already described. It is going to take away from the government its monopoly in this field. It is going to reduce our having to, or eliminate our having to, rely on eyewitnesses to try to document the UFO phenomenon. And here is one thing it is going to do as well, and this I find particularly interesting, Art. The SETI project has been underway since the year 1960. That is when Frank Drake set it up.
Right.
They have been spending tens of millions, hundreds of millions, perhaps by now $1 billion or more, listening into space, trying to document the existence of intelligent civilizations out in our galaxy and universe.
Correct.
What I have proposed, this technology, passive radar, listening essentially for UFOs, could transplant, or it could usurp their preeminence in this field if we can show that UFOs are routinely within a quarter million miles of the planet Earth.
Why don't you call it SETI AH, SETI at home? That's what it would be. I mean, it would be exactly that, search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
Absolutely.
At home, right?
We may eclipse SETI with this if we're successful. Now, I cannot, as the investigator, it would be inappropriate for me to say what the results of this system are going to be. I cannot say what we're going to hear out there. I believe that we're going to detect UFOs. In fact, the company up here in Seattle that makes equipment for meteor scatter communications has a beta test site in Shelton, Washington. That's right at the southern tip of Puget Sound.
Mm-hmm.
They have been listening since about 1975. That station has been in operation. I was once told by one of their chief engineers that they, with their station, which was tuned to stations in Boise, Idaho, and Bozeman, Montana, they were getting, on average, about 2 hits per hour of unusual objects.
All right.
That gives us an idea.
Yeah, it sure does. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Peter Davenport. Hello.
Yes, good morning, Art.
Good morning.
Peter.
Good morning.
Thank God that we have some form of agency to report these sightings, because, as Art mentioned before, there's no official government agency to call these sightings, and thus it appears that there is this agenda that they must maintain, like a facade, that they're not even interested in UFO sightings, although we all know better.
Yes.
Certainly. A couple of things about your project. Peter, if on the surface that they appear that they're not interested in these UFO sightings, then they shouldn't show any concern about your project, you know, and the intention of, you know, what you're trying to do with the with that passive receiver.
That's a good
point.
But
yet, on the other hand, I can only see one such agency that may show some concern, the official no such agency, NSA.
Absolutely.
And I'll give you why. The very most important reason is not that so much the fear of proving the existence of aliens and UFOs. What's more important is their ability to control our freedom of mobility. Let me explain. The power plant. Joe Schmuckatelli figures, oh, free energy. Pops it in his vehicle. Don't need to stop for gas. But then he's a seasoned, aircraft pilot and, you know, builds aircraft and discovers, I don't need wings. I can pop this sucker in, and I can even build my home in a little shuttle bay and park wherever I want to live, any remote area, and fly about, so help me God, wherever I want to go. No paper trail, no credit card. And if quite frankly, they want to have choke points, roadblocks, shut the airports down, you know, shut power off, communications, you know, throw in BPL, whatever they want to do, how are they going to control us and our freedom of mobility? I think that's the major concern.
All right. Well, that and the fact that we're going to see all of their secret military aircraft, and that's a concern I see. I can clearly see this would identify the unidentifiable, and they're not going to like that.
Yeah.
And it's not just UFOs. They're probably not going to care much that you're setting it up to see UFOs. They're going to care that you're going to see their stuff.
Yeah.
That's what they're going
to do. There are rumors that I believe we lost an F-117B, a stealth fighter in Bosnia, several years ago during the Clinton administration. And it is rumored that it had been detected by the Bosnians using a passive radar system.
Oh.
Because stealth aircraft reflect radar or radio waves. It's just that because of the shape of the aircraft, most of the electromagnetic energy that strikes the aircraft's surface is not reflected back in the same direction from which the signal, the impinging signal, came. It is reflected elsewhere. It is deflected, if you will. So a passive radar system will allow the detection of stealth aircraft, and I'm sure the government is more than just a little bit concerned about that.
Me too. So, me too. All right, here, interest of time. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Peter Davenport. Hello.
Hello, hello.
Hi.
Good evening.
Hi. I was wondering for a long time, wouldn't UFOs generate a wavefront and a wake of highly charged ionized particles, which would make RF noise? And can you build a system to listen for it?
Yeah. Very good point. The problem is you wouldn't know what you were listening to unless you knew what that transmitted signal was. But amplifying on your point, it is possible that they may generate trails of ionized particles in the atmosphere the way a meteor does, in which case we'll be able to detect them by reflecting the signal off that trail behind them.
What you're talking about really would allow a picture of whatever it is, if it is sophisticated sufficiently, a picture to be drawn on a screen of what it is screeching across the sky. And
yep.
Going to raise a lot of concerns. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Peter Davenport. Hello. Yes, you.
Oh, okay. The passive radar, could it be launched into space on some sort of platform and used to monitor extraterrestrial activity or anything like that from up in space?
Well, I think Peter's saying it need not be, aren't you, Peter?
Yes, it need not be, but the caller raises an interesting question. When I heard that people were going to be launching satellites into space, companies like Teledesic and Motorola, and they were going to be broadcasting signals down from satellites, I said to myself just about a decade ago, oh, what a perfect, perfect system for detecting any moving object above a country in its atmosphere. It is the ideal system for providing a look-down radar coverage of a large area on the planet Earth. So the caller raises an interesting point. Yes, technically it's possible, would require an immense amount of engineering know-how, however.
When, I'm curious, Peter, when did it hit you, in essence, that we could utilize the military's existing fence?
Several years ago. This is something that I've been ruminating on for a long time. It is just a very attractive proposition because, one, the strength of the signal, number two, the purity of the signal.
Oh, yes.
The continuous wave, I'm sure, is a very, very clean signal, as they call it in radio. You know much, much more about that than I do. And number two, it stretches from San Diego to Fort Stewart, Georgia, I believe is the easternmost terminus of the system. So we have a broad area over which we have access to a very powerful signal. And you could put any number of stations on both sides of the fence and time synchronize them, and you're going to get a whopping amount of data out of space and out of the atmosphere.
Yes, and ultimately you're going to need volunteers receiving sites, and they're going to be able to need to communicate instantly, probably by the Internet or whatever, with some sort of central computer, no doubt, in Seattle somewhere.
Yep.
Okay.
It's not an easy project, but what I anticipate, Art, is that once we get one system done, and I made this point during my talk at MUFON last weekend, once we get one system that is up and running and pretty much bug-free, producing other systems is going to be relatively easy.
Mm-hmm.
All the person needs is a receiver, an antenna, a computer, access to the global positioning system, time synchronization system, and the Internet. What I anticipate is that someday we will have a website to which everybody who operates one of these passive systems will feed the results of his system. So anybody who is interested in knowing what is going on over our heads will have access to that website.
Gotcha.
And they can track things.
And I take it, by the way, information is available on what you've talked about tonight on your website, right?
It is. It may be on your website, too. I don't know if they've posted it, but
we've got a little something up.
My 16-page paper is posted there. In addition, on our homepage at ufocenter.com, ufocenter.com, I have posted about 6 or 8 links to websites which address passive radar. So those people who would like to see a little more technical information than what I've been able to present here tonight will have access to the University of Washington website, for example, in Seattle. There's some very interesting articles, ABC News article about the threat of passive radar to stealth aircraft. There's an article in Business Week, of all things, about stealth technology, and or not stealth, but rather passive radar technology. So there are about 8 websites listed on our website that will provide people with more reading material if they'd like to know more.
All right, let's squeeze another in here. First time caller line, you're on the air with Peter Davenport. Hello.
Hello, this is Chad from Utah. Great show tonight.
Thank you, Chad.
Truck driver, I listen to you on XM 165. Question is, on the FM receiving of the high frequency, could you redirect that on another receiver that anybody with a normal household radio could pick up? And could you link up the site through the Internet using multiple computers for the public to see what is being viewed?
In other words, I think he's saying make a website available, basically dispensing the information you're getting in real time. If you want to be really open about this, then you let everybody see what you're seeing.
Absolutely, and that's my objective, Art. The philosophy of the National UFO Reporting Center is the information we collect belongs to the American people and, in point of fact, every citizen of this planet. The issue of UFOs, in my opinion, and in the opinion of many qualified and intelligent people, is this is real. If it is real, it is the biggest scientific awakening in the history of man. And I feel that the information we collect should be provided to the public as quickly and as thoroughly as we can do it. This philosophy will carry over to the passive radar system. Absolutely.
But, Peter, if you were able to resolve relatively small things and you were seeing what our military is seeing with regard to what passes over our skies and our airspace up above where there's even any air, then, and you're dispensing that information in real time, then you're giving that information virtually to everybody, including other countries and whatever.
Yeah, that's a national defense issue. Perhaps if we don't do it in real time, but there's a time delay of a few minutes or whatever, we can avoid that problem. But one of the interesting angles, an interesting facet to what I've proposed, is for the last 50 years, half a century, we mere citizens and mere UFO investigators have pleaded with organizations like Cheyenne Mountain, the Air Defense Command, for information about UFOs.
Yes.
If we get this network set up, I can foresee a scenario in which they will come to us for information and request whether we might be willing to share with them what we are detecting with our systems.
Granted, that's one scenario.
Yes.
And I see others where guys with rifles come in and take your stuff away.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope our government hasn't gotten to that stage. I've lived under governments like that, and it's very unpleasant. If our government is going down that path, then I think it's time that we force the issue and get some attention on it and get things turned around in this country. This
will do it.
Yes.
Well, all right, Peter, it has been a pleasure having you on the air tonight. Would you like to give out the UFO Reporting Center's hotline number?
Indeed, I would. Our hotline number is area code 206-722-3000. That number again, area code 206 for Seattle, 722-3000 for recent reports only. And I'd be most grateful if people don't flood me with calls tonight after this program. I'm turning the phone off here very shortly. And our website, of course, is www.ufocenter.com. Our trusty webmaster just posted all our newly received reports tonight, and people can read my paper on passive radar, and there are a number of very interesting things up there.
Okay, my friend, thank you and good night.
Good night, Art.
Take care. That's Peter Davenport, and he just lit the fuse on an idea. Ideas are very explosive. From the high desert, that's it for this weekend. Good night.
Midnight in the desert, shooting stars across the sky. This magical journey will take us on a ride, filled with the longing, searching for the truth. Will we make it to tomorrow? Will the sun shine on you? Midnight in the desert.